It's a great honor to be here, and I'm very, very grateful to have a chance to speak with you. I'd like to begin a conversation with my remarks, and then hopefully we'll have some time for discussion, and over the next few days, time for conversation in the halls and during the breaks about spiritual assessment and where we are with the field of spiritual assessment and where we need to go and how we need to get there and how we may, in fact, be able to do this together. And so you can tell I'm killing a little bit of time here while we find the right slide. So to begin, some thoughts about where we are with spiritual assessment. There's a lot of different models for assessment that have been published. One of the things that occurs to me, I would be interested in your reflections on this, is that it seems to me that many of these are discipline-specific. The physicians write models and other physicians know about them. The nurses write models and other nurses know about them. The chaplains write models and other chaplains know about them. But there's very little actual awareness or referencing of models across disciplines in what's been published. I would make the case a few of the models that we have are evidence-based, and that one of the goals we need to be thinking about moving toward is developing evidence-based models for spiritual assessment. There's been very little critical review of the models of spiritual assessment that have been published and generated, and I think that's another important need for our field. And so it leaves clinicians in the situation of and professors, teachers, faculty, what should I recommend? What should I do? How should I incorporate this into my practice? What's the best way to be about this? And so I think that's the kind of situation we're in, and I want to address that situation by following the following outline, and that is to talk a little bit about what is out there now in terms of models both for research briefly and then models for clinical practice, and then talk about what are the issues that we're going to encounter if we try to move ahead in developing evidence-based approaches to spiritual practice. And in general, the issues that we have, I've kind of clumped into two big groups, one group about definitions and norms and one group about methods. So I tend to distinguish the models of measuring religion and spirituality that have been developed for research purposes from models of spiritual assessment that are developed for clinical purposes. And I'd be glad for a conversation about that as to whether or not you think that's a smart thing to do or whether or not you think that there are models that have been developed for research purposes that are actually effective and helpful in clinical practice. But this, as you undoubtedly know, there's an immense literature of models of instruments to measure religion and spirituality that primarily were developed for use in research. And these are just four reviews, of recent reviews, actually, of models that were developed for research purposes, although the work by the Swiss team led by Dr. Monod was also trying to find something that had clinical relevance in terms of being able to be used to measure spiritual need. So if you accept my argument that the research tools are actually not necessarily the best things to be used in clinical practice, I want to talk about three levels of instruments, or three levels of approaching clinical inquiry about spirituality in clinical practice. Frequently, all three of these get called spiritual assessment, but I think it's important to distinguish them. So I make distinctions, my colleagues and I, between spiritual screening, spiritual history taking, and spiritual assessment. So briefly, a description of each of those three levels and then some examples of them. Spiritual screening is designed to be done when the initial contact with someone in a clinical situation, in patient-outpatient situation. It's generally a few brief questions, kind of like a triage, that will help determine whether or not there's some remarkable, important spiritual pain or spiritual distress that deserves further inquiry, further in-depth assessment to confirm, in fact, whether or not there is distress there, and if so, what's the nature of it and what should be done about it. So that screening, one of the ways we think about it, is that screening does not have to be done by spiritual care specialists. It can be done by any healthcare professional, and kind of then guide our further action. The second level that we think about is a spiritual history taking, often done in the context of a more comprehensive history and physical history taking process, getting acquainted with a new patient in a clinical context, in which the clinician has a commitment to holistic kind of care for the patient and wants to include the spiritual dimension in that. And so spiritual history taking often includes several questions designed to kind of draw out from the patient some important parts of religious and spiritual life for them. And when I think of spiritual assessment, I think that spiritual assessment is actually not a series of questions. History taking, screening are both question-based. Assessment is actually, as it's been used up till now, an interpretive framework to understand the religious and spiritual needs and resources of a person we're working with clinically as they emerge in the course of a clinical conversation or relationship that's being developed with a spiritual care specialist. In that sense, it's notable that spiritual assessment is an ongoing process insofar as the relationship is ongoing, that we're learning more about what's happening for the patient and their needs and resources, and we're continuing to refine and develop our assessment. So what are some examples of that? It turns out that the screening is actually pretty important, particularly in inpatient contexts, but it's actually the least developed area. A model for spiritual screening that has been published is a model that my colleague Jay Risk and I published in 2009, and it consists of a series of three or four questions. The first question is, religion or spirituality important to you as you're coping with your illness? If the person says yes, then the question is, to what extent are you getting all the strength and comfort you need from your religion and spirituality? And if they say, I'm getting all the strength and comfort that I need, we don't think there's a red flag. If they say, I'm not getting all that I need, or I'm not getting any at all, we think that that's a main red flag for potential spiritual distress and needs to be followed up to determine whether or not, in fact, there is spiritual pain, spiritual distress. The second pathway is religion, spirituality important to you as you cope with your illness? If the person says no, we don't assume that they're a happy atheist, actually. So we want to know whether or not, in fact, there is some spiritual pain, spiritual concern, spiritual need there. So what we had recommended was to say, has it always been true that spirituality is not important to you? And if the person says, no, actually there was a time when it was important, then we think that that's a potential red flag for something having happened in the, to change from, yes, it was important in the past, no, it's not important now, and to inquire about that. So there's a little bit of research that led to the development of this protocol. We tested it with medical rehabilitation patients. It's been tested with oncology patients in the U.S. Currently, we're actually analyzing some data with bone marrow transplant survivors that suggests that second pathway is not working so well. So it's not, you know, this is not a screening protocol. It's a fully evidence-based protocol, but as we develop it and refine it, I have a hunch that that second pathway isn't going to hold up, but the first pathway does seem to be working pretty well. So in terms of tools for spiritual screening, there are not too many others. Karen Steinhauser, a palliative care researcher in the United States, and her colleagues have used the question, are you at peace? And that appears to be an important indicator in red flag. But the field needs other approaches to screen for potential spiritual distress. We really need to develop them and test them to see whether or not we can do that screening well. The history taking has a number of different different models. And perhaps the most well-known model is the model that Christina Pahulski has developed. This is the FICA model. Christina's developed this and been teaching this for more than a decade. And it's designed for clinicians, physicians, nurses, or other clinicians to draw out the importance of religious spirituality for a patient and some of the details about that. And so a very well-recognized model for spiritual history taking. More recently, I've become aware of the model that was developed by the team at the University of Lausanne and led by Dr. Stephanie Monod, called the Spiritual Distress Assessment Tool. And it's an interview-based assessment that's designed to kind of listen for spiritual needs in five different areas. These are the five different areas of spirituality that team defined. You can't read these, the questions are too small, but these are the questions that can be used by the clinician, chaplain or other clinician, to kind of draw out the patient make an assessment of spiritual need. And I understand several people from that team are here. I'm looking forward to meeting you and hearing some of your workshops in the next few days. It's a very exciting bit of work. In terms of evidence-based models for spirituality, spiritual assessment or spiritual history taking is actually the most robust evidence for any model that I know of is actually the evidence this team has developed, in which they published not only the model, but then they published evidence of its reliability and validity, and it turned out to be quite remarkable in terms of reliability and validity. So I think, should we consider that a model for spiritual assessment or spiritual history taking? Which category do we want to put it in? I tend to think of it as a history taking model, but a very important contribution to the field. So now examples of models for spiritual assessment. In the U.S., the oldest model for spiritual assessment was developed by the psychologist Paul Poiser. It was published in 1976 in a book called Minister as Diagnostician, in which he was trying to encourage clergy to be more thoughtful, chaplains and pastoral counselors to be more thoughtful about their approaches to what he called pastoral diagnosis. We would now call spiritual assessment. And these are he really didn't set out to actually create a set of guidelines, but he offered some recommendations on guidelines for spiritual pastoral diagnosis, and because there wasn't anything else in the field, it became a very, very popular model, and it's also thoughtful and well-developed model. So these are the seven components in his model, 1976. Our team at Rush developed the seven, what's become to call the 7x7 model. We developed it in the mid-1980s, and I published the book in 1993, and we put the spiritual assessment in the context of holistic assessment, which is on the left-hand side, and then we look at seven dimensions of religion and spirituality in the context of that. So a whirlwind tour, three levels: spiritual screening, spiritual history taking, spiritual assessment, some examples of each of them. And now as we think about the strengths and weaknesses and how we move forward in the field toward evidence-based approaches to spiritual screening and spiritual assessment, part of what I suggest we think about is why is it that we do spiritual assessment? And if we keep that in mind in terms of why we're doing it, then I think it helps us also think about what is it we need to do to build good models. And so I would argue that there are three important reasons why we do spiritual assessment. One is to guide the spiritual care. That we need to be thoughtful about the spiritual care we're providing for patients, families, loved ones, and what helps us be thoughtful and competent in that work is the assessment work that we have done that helps shape and direct that. A second important reason for doing spiritual assessment is so when we're working on a multidisciplinary team, we can tell our colleagues what our assessment was of the patient's situation and how that assessment assessment is guiding the care that we plan to provide. And in the U.S., particularly in the inpatient context, part of what we're finding is that when chaplains write lengthy narrative spiritual assessments, busy clinicians have no time for that. And so we need to be able to be efficient in communicating the essential points of the assessment to our clinical colleagues so that they can appreciate the spiritual needs and how the spiritual needs are being addressed. I think the third important thing that needs to happen with spiritual assessment is we need to be able to actually quantify our assessment of the patient's religious and spiritual need so that we know whether or not the spiritual care that was provided led to any improvement. So the diagram here is actually another model for spiritual assessment that was published in the U.S. by a chaplain whose name was Art Lucas. And Art's model for spiritual assessment was what he actually called the profile, the idea of the holy and whether or not someone's, how they're making meaning in the context of their illness and are they part of a religious community. But part of what Art did for chaplains was to say to them, you know, the spiritual assessment is where it begins, and then that leads to a care plan, and then that leads to the intervention, and then after the intervention we have to be thoughtful about whether or not what the intervention has done, can we measure, can we evaluate whether or not the spiritual care we've provided is making a difference and making a difference in the direction that we hoped it would make. And so I think that's a third important component for spiritual assessment, particularly if we can quantify it, is that we can then evaluate whether or not the care we're providing is helping things in the directions that we were hoping that it would. So when I just review the evidence, this is a kind of scorecard about where we are with evidence-based approaches to spiritual screening and assessment, the rough screening protocol, our liabilities, unknown, the validity is only partial, clinical usefulness. We have some partial evidence, it's true, but I haven't shared the MD Anderson spiritual assessment model. It's more like a history-taking model. Again, the evidence for that is under development. The spiritual distress assessment tool from our colleagues in Switzerland probably has the most validity and reliability related to it. The spiritual injury scale it's called a scale. It was designed by a chaplain for use by chaplains in the United States, and Gary Berg working in our Veterans Affairs hospitals. And there's some evidence of its validity and reliability. But in general, we really haven't done a good job yet with these screening and assessment tools. We have a long way to go. And this is just another way to look at that. It is, so the Rush 7x7, the Rush screening protocol, Christina's FICA, Gary Berg's spiritual injury scale, are they quantifiable? Two are, two aren't. Is there validity, evidence of validity? Some is, and in some cases not. Do we have evidence that they're clinically useful? There's actually ways to study that in some of our spiritual assessments models. We don't have evidence for that. So inclusive, right? One of the challenges for spiritual assessment is, can we use the same assessment model for people from a wide variety of religious backgrounds or people who would say, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, and I'm spiritual in these ways. So what's the evidence that any of these models work across diverse religious and spiritual backgrounds? That's an area where we have a lot of work to do. And then I'm going to talk about local versus universal models for spiritual assessment. Local models is my way of saying the chaplain at this hospital developed it, and they use it, but nobody else knows about it. If you think in medicine, for example, or in nursing, this is the way we define blood pressure. When we define blood pressure, we define hypertension this way at our hospital, and some other hospital may define hypertension some other way, right? And so that's kind of the situation we're in with spiritual assessment. We have a variety of local models, but we don't have any universally accepted definitions, and that makes it very hard for the field to progress. One of the things that makes it hard, for example, in the U.S., physicians physician who trains in one hospital meets a chaplain and gets to know a chaplain who's using one approach to spiritual assessment. They finish their training, they go on to work in another hospital, and the chaplains over there are using three different models. Three different chaplains each have their own. And so when the physicians are done, they say, you know, this spiritual stuff is a little confusing for me, right? Everybody has a local model. So how do we move ahead? Well, that's not going to be easy. I'm not going to actually answer the question about how we move ahead. Hopefully, I'm going to describe the issues that we face in moving ahead in a thoughtful and helpful way so that over the next few days we can have some conversations about how to move ahead. And as I say, there are two major ways I want to talk about this. One is around the issues of definitions and norms, and the other is around the issues of methods. And for definitions and norms, you know, they're the issues of defining religion and spirituality, they're the issues of norms in assessment, and the issues of roles and authority. So, you know, I don't need to kind of belabor the issue about there's lots of different definitions of spirituality and religion and spirituality that are being used, and they're not all similar. These are definitions from Ken Pargman, psychologist of religion in the United States, whose work I highly respect and been pretty influential for me, but it's not the only ways that it's defined. So going back to those reviews of the models, reviews of the instruments for use in clinical practice. Lucy Selman and her colleagues reviewed a whole bunch of models for measuring religion and spirituality, and out of their review of that, they came up with this model of spirituality. And then the same year, a Dutch team reviewed a whole set of instruments, and they came up with this model of spirituality. And it's just one, my way of kind of saying there's a lot of different models and definitions out there. There's some overlap among them. Perhaps it's possible to integrate them, but it's just not a small challenge in terms of coming up with definitions of spirituality. There are good models, evidence-based models for spiritual screening, history-taking, and assessment. So I'm done with definitions. We can talk more about that if you'd like. But here's the issue of norms. There's a journal called the Journal of Christian Bioethics that published a special issue on spiritual assessment in December of 2013 called The False Gods of Spiritual Assessment. And so they're pretty critical of current practice in spiritual assessment. And one of the essays in the special issue was this essay with this title in which the author, Devin Stahl, actually used some clinical instruments, research instruments. I think one was Ken Pargman's brief, R. Cope, and the other was the Facet SP, to assess Julian of Norwich and assess Martin Luther. And her conclusion was that if we used the assessments, those instruments, those clinical instruments, we would actually find both of these people had serious problems with their spiritual wellness. And so it's a clever way of pointing out that all models for assessment at some point have norms built into them. And how do we recognize the norms, identify the norms, use them in ways that are helpful to people and not harmful to people? So that's one of the challenges, I think, that we have in developing models for screening and assessment. Finally, one of the issues is actually who is it that should be doing spiritual assessment? Should it be physicians? Should it be nurses? This actually is a very old picture of a famous U.S. chaplain. His name was Russell Dix. He was a kind of pioneer in modern chaplaincy in the United States, who for a brief period of time actually worked at the hospital, one of the predecessor hospitals to Rush University, where I currently work now. But there is debate in the literature, actually, as to whether or not it should be part of a nurse's role to be doing spiritual assessment. We heard from Donya, and we certainly would hear from others, that it should be clearly part of a nurse's role, but not every nurse actually feels that way, and there's a debate in the literature about whether or not that's true. And so which health professionals should be doing what level of clinical inquiry and clinical care and spiritual care? So it's one of the challenges that we face in the field as we move forward. Thank you. So if that's not enough, here are three more. They're kind of more methodological. One is whether or not spiritual assessment can be quantitative, whether or not we should have one assessment for every diagnostic group, or whether or not we should have diagnostic-specific assessments, and then the issue of local versus universal that I mentioned. So in the U.S., or actually in North America, chaplains have historically been resistant to measurement tools and using measurement tools in chaplaincy. And so when the language of spiritual assessment was first introduced, the chaplains often thought that meant they had to go in to the patient's room, the clipboard, and ask the patient a bunch of questions as part of a kind of research-like instrument. And that made chaplains very, very uncomfortable. So there's a lot of resistance about that notion of spiritual assessment. These are comments that were made to Tom O'Connor. Tom is a leading Canadian pastoral counselor, chaplaincy researcher, who interviewed chaplains in Canada and asking them about spiritual assessment. And it, you know, just gives you the feel for how chaplains prefer a narrative approach. And actually, in the standards for chaplaincy in Canada, the Canadian Spiritual Care Association, the language about spiritual assessment is that the chaplains must use narrative approaches to spiritual assessment. That language is not in the U.S. Chaplaincy standards, but it is in the Canadian standards. So this notion of a quantitative approach to spiritual need or spiritual distress or spiritual pain or spiritual resources is one that makes chaplains at least moderately uncomfortable. May not be so difficult for other healthcare colleagues in other healthcare professions to think about quantifying our spiritual assessments in addition to having kind of a rich narrative on which they're based. So this is Arbuckus's model again, and this is the model from our colleagues in Switzerland. And the Swiss model was developed for use, as I understand it, in geriatric rehabilitation. And so there's a kind of specificity about the spiritual needs that patients in geriatric rehabilitation are facing, and the assessment tool then is built around those common spiritual needs. Up to now, models for spiritual assessment have been more like Lucas's model, in which they've attempted to be universal, that the same spiritual assessment would be good in palliative care, it would be good for congestive heart failure patients, it would be good for patients with new diagnoses of cancer, it would be good for patients with some serious mental health problems. And we thought that one size in some sense would fit all patients in all situations. And I think that's an important question for us to have a conversation about. I'm not so sure that the one size fits all is the way we should be moving ahead in this field. So then, you know, I've already mentioned the issue about local versus universal, and that, again, these are data from Tom O'Connor and the Canadian chaplains. The vast majority of Canadian chaplains were using a spiritual assessment model that they had developed or that the chaplains in their department had developed, and they actually were not well aware of published models that existed in the field and, for the most part, were not using them. These data are a little bit old, about 10 years old. That's probably changed a little bit. More chaplains are probably more aware of models that have been published, but mostly they're not using them. They're adapting them. They're developing their own. Their own local situation is shaping that. And as I say, they're kind of having each institution, and sometimes within one institution, each chaplain using different models for spiritual assessment it certainly doesn't help around communicating what the chaplain's doing and what spiritual care is about to our healthcare colleagues, and I think it creates other barriers toward developing good evidence-based approaches to spiritual screening, history taking, and assessment. So it's an important priority in my mind, and apparently in others as well. These are data from the Spiritual Care Task Force of why I'm forgetting this, right? Someone will know this better than I do. This is, again, a work led by Lucy Selman, who surveyed European health professionals, I think palliative care professionals, about the European Association of Palliative Care Task Force. Thank you, Christine. Right. So surveyed them about what the priorities were for spiritual care and published that recently. And you'll see that coming up with a good evidence-based screening tool actually turns out to be a high priority for people in that survey as well. So I think moving ahead, trying to develop good ways to do this is an important concern for all of us. So just a few more things, and then we'll have some topic conversation about what some of the challenges are. So this is, in some way, by way of summary and review, you know, can we come up with approaches that build on narrative interviews, but that also can have a quantifiable component to them? Can we, if we do, in fact, move toward quantifying it, can we be sure of the validity of that? Models really do have to be useful. There's at least three things that are part of the usefulness of any model. So the 7x7 model that we developed at Rush that I took an important role in is not useful. The chaplains say, this is too complicated. I can't understand this. It takes too much time. But busy clinicians do have to have models that are efficient. And if they are complex, it has to be clear to the clinician, both the chaplain and others, that why that complexity is necessary. So that whatever approach has to be an approach that's acceptable to patients, has to be acceptable to the chaplains, and as I said earlier, has to efficiently provide information to other busy clinicians. We need to find models that are inclusive, but that's actually an area for debate. There are Harold Koenig is part of a team that has published several papers that talk about the universal spirituality and models that try to assess spirituality at a universal kind of level not being very useful, that what really is very useful is actually the particularity of people's religious traditions that gives them strength and comfort in particular crisis situations. And the group that published the special issue of Christian Bioethics actually takes a similar position, that it's actually the distinctiveness of specific traditions. And so the notion actually of one model of spiritual assessment that works for the Catholics and the Lutherans and the Seventh-day Adventists and the Baptists and the Jews and the Muslims and every, you know, is a very important question actually, whether or not that's a realistic way to think about this and achievable. But at the very least, the models have to, I think, be respectful of all of those traditions and not impose the norms and values, for example, of one faith tradition on another in a way that might potentially pathologize that tradition. And then finally, I've already talked about the universal and local thing as another kind of challenge. So, again, to kind of wrap up and maybe point to some directions, I'm kind of leaning toward the idea that we're going to do better if we have a number of different diagnostic-specific assessments. Maybe not, you know, different assessment for patients with diabetes and patients with, I don't know, some other chronic condition, as to how specific all of that has to be in terms of diagnostic specific. I think that's something we should be talking about. Probably we need multi-level systems. We need good screening that helps us know not every person needs in-depth spiritual assessment. So how do we do the screening to help us know reliably who needs the in-depth spiritual assessment? So we need multi-level approaches to this. I think ideally the approaches will combine quantitative and narrative approaches, and that we need to efficiently know what is it that our healthcare colleagues and other professions, the physicians and nurses and others who are working with the patients, really need to know so that we can kind of just zero in on that information to provide them the important highlights of what's going on. One of the ways I think about this is that there's actually an important body of research about the role of religion and spirituality in coping with severe mental illness, the role of religion and spirituality in coping with cancer, the role of religion and spirituality in coping with medical rehabilitation problems. And can we use that research actually, in some sense, as the Swiss team did, to begin to identify the key spiritual needs associated with different medical issues, and out of that develop and test models and then disseminate those models. So, can I do one more slide? Thank you. So this is just to say, time for some conversation. This is my colleague, Pat Murphy. Pat and I together do the research program at Rush. We have a little bit of a website. And that's our beautiful new building with the skyline of Chicago in the background. So I hope this has been helpful. I look forward to a few minutes of conversation now and as much conversation as we can have over the next few days.
From you, anyone would like?
Would it help to turn on the lights?
Can I start off? I'm down here. Mike Sheldon, a GP. It's my view that most patients don't know what their own spiritual needs are, and therefore the only way to discover them is an ongoing relationship and reassessment. So one tool at one period of time is not as useful as it, as we often think it should be. Do you agree?
Yes, completely.
End of question.
Yes. Very often some patients will be self-reflective and be able to kind of provide some description of their spiritual struggle in a way that the clinician can say, okay, well, if this is the spiritual struggle, this is what we'll do together to kind of begin to adjust. But more often it's going to come out in a conversation and over time. Yes. Sure.
Thank you very much for a very interesting talk. I'm Jacqueline Watts. I'm from the Open University in the UK. Just a couple of things. You've drawn a distinction that you've taken from the literature between universal and deeply individual and the personal and the local in terms of a values base. And a comment, really, I wanted to offer really reflects the mantra in so much healthcare, particularly in policy around person-centred care. So that would suggest, wouldn't it, that the local, the individual, the idiosyncratic might be something we would expect to take the lead on, that you would start from where the person is. So I just wanted to offer that. And tomorrow I'm speaking, and you've stolen my thunder. But you know what? I'm not going to be put off. Thank you very much.
I apologize for that, Jacqueline. So, just to be clear about when I say local, what I mean is not the local patient. All of the idiosyncratic. What word do I want? What of the uniqueness of the individual patient is part of what we want to hear and part of what we want the spiritual assessment to help us understand more deeply and respectfully. What I mean is that the models for assessment are all local. So it was if your institution decided that hypertension was going to be 155 and somebody else's institution decided hypertension was going to be 135 and somebody else has decided it would be 115. And that we have all these local, that That's what I mean by local models of measuring hypertension, defining hypertension. We have local models for spiritual assessment developed at each little chaplain's department, and we don't have a universal model. So what does it mean to... Is it worth thinking about developing a model for spiritual assessment that actually gets adopted across institutions because it is so persuasive and so informative? And, you know, in some sense, we have models that have been adopted in lots of places. Christina Spica would be an example. Lots and lots of clinicians are using it. So it's beginning to move in that direction. But, you know, further research would be needed to kind of undergird it. Yes, Renee.
I wonder about, I'm coming from a medical background, and so for us it's very clear that we just have standards. But does this something to do with the pastoral thinking or with the pastoral understanding of man? Why do you think there is a difference or maybe a resistance on that?
It's not clear yet whether or not there's resistance. We should ask some of the other chaplains to comment on that. But because of the emphasis on each person as being unique and special, that has been such an important part of the, I think, formation of pastoral and spiritual care, the notion of a kind of universal model for assessment has been strange for us. As a field, it hasn't been part of our field. As we rub shoulders more and more with other health professionals, we realize, okay, there are some standards that other health professionals use to actually shape and inform and guide practice. And would it be better actually for chaplains to begin to think about what are the standards that would be helpful for us? And how do we get down to the details for that? So it's been a new way for us to think. Poyser's book, you know, the Minister's Diagnostician book, in some sense, 1976, was a wake-up call to pastor counselors, chaplains, and pastors in the U.S. to begin thinking that way. It was pretty new thinking at the time. But the other chaplains should engage with Renee over that. Other comments? Yeah, Christina, please.
Great connection, which really excellent. I'm willing to point out that I did borrow from your slide, though, because I do think while the history questions are questions, they evolve in relationship. You know, it's opening up a question, and conversations can go way off the tool, and that also makes it hard to study as well as to simplify. And then from the first comment, the first question, Marvin Delgado at MD Anderson added a spiritual distress question to the distress thermometer for the palliative care patients, and he graphed it out. And what's really interesting, and again, supports what this first gentleman said, what you said, but also the fact that it happens in relationship with all of us as clinicians as well, is that initially, while people had a lot of distress, say, in physical and psychosocial dimension, the spiritual distress was usually related a little bit low. Until, as people got better, actually, they started identifying the spiritual distress. And, you know, he's suspecting, and I think I agree, that you raise the question, a physician raises the question, or a nurse raises the question, the person starts thinking about those questions and maybe identifies it. So there is something to be said for taking time with all the clinicians, chaplains, and others before these things are recognized. And also, if you just ask a question and the patient on the initial visit says, no, I don't have any spiritual concerns, and then it's never asked again, you're missing some serious concerns.
Thank you. Hey, Fox.
George, picking up on Renee's question, it strikes me that the subject matter is much more complicated and harder to abstract. When we abstract it, we lose more content than we do when we abstract something like acute MI or even a chronic illness. So I note that with the DSM-5 coming out, one of the things that was really striking was a study done that showed even expert evaluators, psychiatrists, psychiatrist trained in the systematic standard evaluation of depression had a very low inter-rater agreement in the diagnosis of depression, of moderate depression. And if you take something like the spiritual stupidity of someone, it's that much more complicated than the story of a Martin Luther or any of our patients is that much more complicated even than depression. So I think that's part of why we struggle to depend too much on assessments.
So the Institute for Spirituality and Health in the Texas Medical Center, Houston. Our mission is to disseminate information to people, as you know, about the evidence, scientific evidence-based practices of spiritual and religious practices that promote healing. And my question is, in everything that you presented, I didn't hear a step in that process to inform the patient about the results of that type of research. It would be the equivalent, I would think, of asking a patient, are you interested in open heart surgery without, and they say no, and have you ever had open heart surgery? No. Would you like to have it? No. And, well, thank you for your time. Maybe a little more information to give to them without promoting a particular religion or faith or spiritual practice in a scientific way would give them an informed decision to make rather than uninformed. Could you comment?
I'd love to see research about what that does. I think it's a very, very interesting idea to you know, which patients would respond to which research, which way, and therefore what does that mean for clinical practice? I'd love to see, you know, some people begin implementing that so we can learn how it's helpful and for whom. Yes, please, will you?
Thank you. My name is Naomi Kalish. I'm from New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. I've been a long fan of your work and love that I had to come to Malta to meet you in person. So my question, actually I have a comment first that leads to my question. So two pieces of your talk, which I especially appreciated, were one addressing the issue of local versus universal with regard to diversity issues, religious and other areas of diversity, and the second being the need for the assessment tool to be acceptable to both patients and to chaplains. So I have found that sometimes some of the critique of an assessment tool comes out of the chaplain's own identity, whether it's religious or cultural, and from a patient-centered perspective, the assessment tool needs to reflect and be able to somehow capture or transmit something about the patient's spirituality. But because this is a human-to-human encounter, the chaplain's spirituality and worldview is also significant. So I'm wondering, I tend to think about theological reflection as the tool that a chaplain uses to make sense for him or herself of the situation, and spiritual assessment being with a patient, what we use to understand the patient. But there is some tension between trying to enter the world of the patient while also being limited by our own identity and worldview. So I'm wondering if you would comment on that or where theological reflection might fit in.
I think it's well said, Naomi. I don't know how to say that better. You know, any spiritual care provider, chaplain or other health professional who, you know, has done in-depth study and is providing spiritual care does have to have a way to think, okay, how do I make sense of this in my own religious and spiritual life, and what does that mean for how well I'm listening to this patient and understanding and responding to them, and when is it that actually I can't respond to them? I need to refer it to somebody else who, you know, may be closer to them or better understanding of them. But no, I think the distinction, you know, this theological reflection is what I'm doing for myself. Spiritual assessment is how I'm understanding the patient. It makes a lot of sense. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. So